mind in this API for some time, and glad I kind of made it. Today I'm talking about some work I've been doing, well, recently and still in progress with Jim Klein, Abigail, and Fang Chen, who's his graduate student. And as the title says, I'll be talking about a particular model of dark matter that's acquired the moniker exciting dark matter for actual physics purpose reasons. And I'm talking about sort of some new ideas we've had regarding how to make that particular model work better. So in terms of what I'm going to talk to you about, I understand that you've probably had a couple of seminars already about some of these issues. But I'm just going to review some of the hints that have been popping up sort of observationally over the last few years that have gotten people thinking about dark matter again. And then I'll describe the need for what's called a boost factor, or some enhancement of cross-sections that would be needed to help dark matter explain the various signals that have been popping up. Then I'll describe the focus of our work, which was coming up with, we'll call it, inverted model of dark matter, or some new particle physics model of dark matter. And then I'll just close with talking about the future direction. So what are the hints that have been coming up about dark matter recently? Well, hey, here's everyone's sort of favorite picture of the bullet cluster, which shows, you know, hot gas in the center and something outside that's causing gravitational lensing. And this is sort of an extragalactic picture of dark matter in its usual interpretation. I want to talk about today mostly dark matter in the galaxy, here in the Milky Way, and, well, presumably the same sorts of things would be happening elsewhere, but where we can actually see is here, of course. So what are just an overview of some of the observations that have been coming up recently? Well, there are a number of direct detection experiments. Of course, large detectors looking for dark matter particles coming in and striking things. Most of these have not actually seen anything, and that's been putting limits on some properties of dark matter particles. But one experiment, DAMA, has claimed to record dark matter scattering off the targets. But like I said, none of the others have. So there's some controversy about this. But one potential idea that's been proposed to say that, well, DAMA really has been seeing dark matter and nothing else, none of the other experiments have, is that the dark matter is scattering inelastically off the targets. And I'll explain why that can explain this discrepancy between DAMA. Another place that there's an interesting astrophysical signal is there are a lot of excess high-energy electrons and positrons that have been seen in several different types of measurements and a number of different experiments. You may have heard of Kamala, which measures sort of the positron fraction and sees an anomalous excess of positrons. Attic, which looks at the total energy in electrons and positrons at even higher energies. And there are a number of other observations, so the biggest one. There's also been pointed out, if you look in the WMAP data near the galaxy, after subtracting out all the known foregrounds, there's still some haze in the microwaves, which appears to be consistent with synchrotron radiation, again, from high-energy electrons and positrons that seem to be in excess of what's there. One possible explanation for these is that, well, there's some TeV scale dark matter, which is decaying into high-energy electrons and positrons, or possibly annihilating. Now, there are potentially some astrophysical explanations as well. For example, pulsars could be injecting some high-energy Q plus minus into the galaxy. But, you know, for fun, let's assume that it's not astrophysics. But let's assume that perhaps we really are learning something about dark matter and see if we can build some consistent model. Finally, there's a 500 keV photon line. So which basically looks like it's coming from annihilations of electrons and positrons, basically at rest. The best measurements currently are by an integral experiment, but this is an anomaly that's been seen for almost 40 years. We've known that there's sort of more of these 511 keV photons than expected. Now, what integral's done is really map it on the sky, and you see there's a really strong bulge component. So these largely seem to be coming out of the center of the galaxy. Again, there are possible astrophysical explanations, but if we're going to play the game of assuming that it's dark matter, again, what could it be? Well, it could be that there's perhaps some light dark matter that's decaying or lighting. Or it could be heavy dark matter with several different states that are split by, about MeV, the mass of electron positron pair. So what I'm going to focus on today is these kind of explanations that maybe there's an elastic scattering, that the dark matter is annihilating to create these many GeV electrons and positrons, and that perhaps the dark matter transitions that are creating these electrons and positrons mostly at rest, which are then annihilating and giving these 511 keV photons.
You need a different mechanism for those two things because they can't be the same thing?
Right.
Why is that?
Well, for one thing is that the really high energy ones they have to be coming from closer. They can't propagate that far. I guess you could potentially come up with some reason that the ones created in the center of the galaxy are at high energies are slowing down before they can. I think it may just be that it takes too long. I'm not sure. Because these are, you're talking about extremely relativistic electrons versus things that are basically electrons. Okay, so first, let me give you a few more details about the direct detection experiments. And again, please slow me down or stop me with your question. But why would Dhamma be able to see dark matter and not the other experiments? Well, okay, how do direct detection experiments work? You're typically looking for dark matter particles coming in and scattering off some nucleus. Now, this has only been seen to happen at the Dhamma experiments. And I guess they've done a couple of iterations and claimed to see scattering for almost a decade now. And there are, again, possibly candidate scattering events that have been detected in other experiments, although that's not the usual position that we'll turn out. Now, the main difference, however, between Dhamma and, for example, the Cold Dark Matter Search CDMS, which is a competitor, is that Dhamma uses heavier nuclei. And what does this mean? Well, suppose the dark matter is scattering inelastically. So it's coming in some state one and scattering off nucleus into some state two, which is excited, has a slightly higher mass. In order to make that excitation, if you go to the center of mass frame, then, the kinetic energy of this collision has to be bigger than the mass gap, which means you want the reduced mass of the system to be as large as possible to help you have enough kinetic energy. That's just bigger for heavier targets. So for Dhamma, you can actually, so the idea is suppose that delta M, the mass gap, is such that you just can't excite, or you can't collide in this inelastic way at CDMS, but you can at Dhamma. And that would explain why the detectors of heavy nuclei can see dark matter of the
dark. What's the element that they're scattering from in that one?
I believe it's Magna. For this to work, that means you need to choose what the mass gap is appropriately, and it turns out to be about 100 keV. Now, I will say this. Dhamma remains somewhat controversial as an experiment for various reasons. for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to remain agnostic about it.
I recently talked to David Klein, who runs the Zeppelin.
Right.
He told me that he's very angry with the Dalit people.
Well, sure,
with
yeah.
The lady in particular. And the Dalit people refuse to give out any data to them, him, and others. So we can't tell whether what they're doing is correct.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the problem. It's, you know, there's not any way to do any independent analysis. There, I guess, have been a number of, sort of political problems related to Dhamma. I think a few years ago, a number of people left the corporation because of issues.
He doesn't believe the result.
Yeah, a lot of people, that's right, a lot of people don't believe the result. And, like I said, for the purposes of this talk, I want to remain sort of agnostic about it. You know, there are particle physics reasons why it could be right, but they're not necessarily so. The particular model that I'm going to end up presenting to you today would not support the sort of explanation for Dhamma anyway. So,
which you regard as a check mark for the model, right?
Some people would. Depends on your point of view. Yeah, right.
So it's not like church.
No. Well, not like.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. So the next set of signals I'm going to talk about has to do with these high energy electrons and particles. So I guess you've heard about the Fermilab experiment, which is looking for the positron fraction, you know, versus the total electrons and positrons at sort of some large range of energies, and they start to see in excess over expected the positron fraction at about 10 GeV. Now, as I said, there are astrophysical possible explanations, such as pulsars injecting positrons into the system. But it's also consistent, for example, with 100 plus GeV dark matter particles decaying with a lifetime that's actually several orders of magnitude longer than the age of the universe, or consistent with dark matter annihilation with a cross section that's sort of 100 or maybe 1,000 times, depending on how you play the parameters, times the usual wimpy perturbative cross section. So, you know, either if we want to make a dark matter explanation, we need some long but not completely stable, long-lived but not completely stable particle, or we need something that collides more frequently than we expect from usual weak, usual wimp models of Earth. Now, something that sort of adds some emphasis to this signal from Fermilab is a signal from Attic, which is sort of the experiment with the smallest error bars in this plot here, the red dots. But it's also been seen by experiments including PPBS and a number of others. You can see here is this solid line here is expected, I think it's the energy spectrum of electrons and positrons running from, about a GeV on up. And you see that there's an excess compared to the expected astrophysical background from about 100 to 800. Broad spectrum and a peak. See, there is a distinct peak here. Now, what's interesting is that this is consistent with Fermilab in the sense that if you had a single source of positrons, or electrons of positrons, that kicks in at about 10 GeV and grows the way that Fermilab is showing, then you'd expect to find about this many excess electron positrons in these higher. So that's consistent. And for that reason, you know, there's the range of explanations is similar. So I want to focus on the idea that there could be dark matter that's annihilating sort of other dark matter. And This, I should point out, needs to be what's called electrophilic. We don't see any excess antiprotons. It's just excess positrons. There needs to be some reason that, you know, the annihilation channel is dominantly into electrons. Any questions on this one? Okay, furthermore, there is this issue of the W map haze, which says, well, when we subtract all the foregrounds we can think of for microwaves coming from the center of the galaxy, that's something that Douglas Finkfeiner has done, looking at the W map haze, we still find some excess microwaves, so these bright spots around here and here, near the galactic center. And this is consistent, and again, he's gone through and checked several possible explanations. One, well, the spectrum appears to be synchrotron radiation by high energy electron positron. And again, he and his collaborators found this is consistent, at least, with these electrons and positrons being produced by dark matter. So we'll focus on that. And again, of course, there could be other explanations. But for fun, let's see what we can get out of our analysis.
What's the synchrotron statement? They don't have a spectrum, do they?
Well, they have, since WMF looks at like several different bands, they have, like 3 to 5.
So the thing is that that's consistent with so what you'd expect for synchrotron radiation.
That's right. Of hard electrons. Not, you have a different spectrum for low energy.
Probably too early to ask this question. When does the fun stop and you can tell the difference between astrophysics and dark matter?
That's right. Well, okay. Regarding at least these higher energy electrons, can you
tell?
Well, okay. So, in terms of these higher energy electrons and positrons, we know the ones that we're seeing here at Earth can't be coming from too far away because, like I mentioned before, they don't propagate very far. So you might ask, can we tell if they're coming from point sources, which would be likely to have an astrophysical origin, particularly if, say, these point sources happen to be near the pulsars? So the GLAST satellite, I guess it's now called Fermi, has recently been launched. And it should, well, at least my understanding is that we'll have be able to image whether or not this is sort of a diffuse origin of these electrons and positrons or point sources. So there's a very good possibility that within a few years we'll know whether or not these things are coming from some known astrophysical source like a pulsar, or if they're coming from all around, which we think. So there actually does seem to be, some relatively near future test to distinguish at least some of the astrophysical possibilities. But I say, in the meantime, it's very interesting to consider whether or not some relatively simple particle physics models could explain, a number of these different experimental anomalies all at once. Now, I mentioned on the last couple of pages talking about dark matter annihilation, and I said in order to fit the number of electrons and positrons that we're seeing in excess, we need about 100 to 1,000 volt boost in the cross section for annihilation just to get enough boost. I'll come back to that later. Finally, I want to just mention this 500 kDb line again, which has been observed for almost 4 years. And again, it's, looks like electron-positron annihilation nearly at rest. And as we see from the integral data, it's really predominantly a bulge component with just a little bit of the disk. And both possibilities for explaining this include various forms of novae, supernovae. The question about that is, can the positrons escape from the novae well enough to diffuse out into this campus at all. It could be from annihilation or decay of light dark matter, so MEV scale dark matter. Then people wonder, you know, is the distribution custody enough? And the final possibility, which is consistent with heavy dark matter, is called exciting dark matter. And the idea is you just come in with some light state or some dark matter state, one which is lighter than others, and it collides with itself and excites up to some state two with a higher mass. There's some mass splitting that's around, you know, a little bit bigger than 2 times the mass of the electron. So then the second state can decay back down to the ground state and release the plus and minus. Again, this requires a boosted cross section, just like the annihilation. I should also mention there are slight ways you can tweak this model, and actually, the particle physics model for that is sort of another version.
You're saying both those things require boosting, even the integral thing?
That's right. If you want to use exciting dark matter to explain integral, to get enough electrons and positrons, you still would need those for this excitation.
But not for the light dark matter.
No, for the light dark matter,
it's just abundant enough because it's light.
I think that's right.
So the thing that's different with exciting dark matter is it's going to be masses or hundreds of GeV or something.
That's right. So it's still, you know, wimp scale dark matter, but, you know, there's some fine splitting between some different states. Okay, so let me sketch the basic particle physics ideas before I get into them in more detail. The reason a lot of people have become excited about dark matter and Brother and I've been working on it is an observation that R. Cunningham and Finkbeiner, Slatyer, and Weiner made maybe 6 months ago, which is that non-abelian symmetry breaking in the dark matter sector could be key to this full range of physics. And, well, philosophically, people often assume there's just one kind of dark matter. But if you imagine that there were some dark sector, and there were people living in the dark sector and trying to observe us, they might think, well, all I can see is gravity. Maybe there's just one kind of particle. And they'd be missing the entire standard model. We don't need an entire standard model, but you know, it's perfectly reasonable to expect that there should be a sector of dark matter, not just one type. And this is the philosophy. So how can non-abelian symmetry breaking explain all these various ideas? Well, the first thing it can do is explain why the dark matter would decay or annihilate two electrons and positrons. The reason is, suppose that the dark matter is, you know, it's interacting with some spontaneously broken symmetry. The gauge bosons have masses that are typically less than the dark matter, and we'll see can be quite easily, you know, GeV scale or less. These dark matter gauge bosons can mix with the photon with some small coupling. And so if we can produce the dark matter gauge boson resonantly or on shell with a mass of, you know, GeV or less, they're going to decay only E plus E minus, because that's all that they can kinematically decay to. So that's one point. Second, if we want to look at the mass of the dark matter particles, and we're looking for mass splittings to explain possibly the domino experiment or integral, mass splittings are automatically generated at one loop order by diagrams like this once we have a broken non-abelian symmetry, just because the different gauge bosons oriented that loop would have different masses. And in fact, the mass splitting is roughly the gauge boson mass times the fine structure constant of this dark gauge. If you have a gauge boson at a GeV, and, well, then the gauge coupling, you know, say it's order of 10th, the fine structure constants, 10 to the minus 3, that naturally gives you MeV mass splitting. And it's not very hard to arrange for something that's, you know, a tenth of that at 100 kV. So you can very easily get the mass splitting if you want for an elastic dark matter model to explain gamma, or for the exciting dark matter models to explain the factor in 11 KeV model.
Now, if you have a loop, you also have photons interacting with the dark matter, quantum scattering.
Oh.
True alpha. Like we don't see dark matter.
So this is, this alpha is not the electric?
It's not fine structure.
It's the fine structure constant of the dark matter.
So how big does it, how small does it have to be so you don't see dark matter through photons?
Well, okay, so that's really more like this coupling here. But well, the way it works out is that I've oversimplified for the purpose of this slide, but the kinetic mixing is really with the hypercharge cage. So it turns out that when you do electron weak breaking, this thing's really mainly mixing with the zine. So there's not, well, the coupling to the photon is already suppressed.
I think it did. I think it couples to the photon. I mean, it couples to the photon also, but as long as epsilon is small, then
yeah, that's right.
you can get by spider bounds. Well, so if epsilon is 10^-3, then you're good.
Yeah, well, in this case, epsilon's usually taking 10^-3 or 10^-4, but in our case, the direct coupling to the photons are over epsilon squared.
The couple to the Z presumably produce the shear electric and fields as well.
Yeah, it's probably true. Well, maybe it's true. We're not going to see those so much.
But that would reduce the function rate for electrons.
Yeah. Right. But here, in fact, it's too
great. The problem is that it's sort of schizophrenic, because you have to hide things so you don't see it. But at the same time, you have to produce something you can
observe. Yeah, that's right. You're saying this coupling here, doesn't need to be too small to avoid sort of the, thinking that we actually see the dark matter in light, but still leave a fairly rapid decay for these things to electrons and photons and the others. So, I guess the point is there's a white zone. So I'm going to continue.
How small is that need to be to expand in theory? How minimal than your epsilon? In theory.
Gosh. I think it can be quite small. What's really important for an integral is that you excite the dark and that the decay, of the excited state, not the aging universe. So it can still be quite small to avoid that. I don't know the number directly off the top of my head. But I guess the point to say, even with 10^-3 or -4, the decay of the excited state is still maybe a few microseconds. So, and you can see that you can go quite. Okay, finally, something else that comes up naturally from the particle physics of spontaneous symmetry breaking is you can at least get some amount of boost factor just from the fact that there's a gauge flip. Now, one way sort of that's due to our uncertainty in knowing about dark matter, or let's say its density profile, is to note that, the flux that we would see for Pamela or Attic is proportional to the density squared, number density squared of the dark matter. So we can just imagine that maybe for some reason the dark matter number density is enhanced by a few near the center of the galaxy that would get the flux up. But, you need maybe an order of magnitude or more, and that might be pushing it, it's nice to think that already, just in the particle physics model, you get some enhancement of the scattering rate, or directly the cross section, because, well, the gauge forces or gauge particles can, you know, act in these ladder type of diagrams to attract the dark matter particles to each other if they're moving towards each other slowly enough. This has long been known quantum mechanically. It's called Sommerfeld enhancement, and I'll explain a little more later. So finally, let me just put it together and review. Because we've got light gauge bosons that are the only coupling to the standard model, that explains why we can produce only E plus E minus. So the, well, we don't have enough mass to produce protons and antiprotons. Now, for XDM, it's very natural to have MEV scale mass splittings due to one loop effects. And similarly, for the inelastic dark matter models, it's not too hard to imagine that maybe there are other, you know, well, some of these same one loop effects are a little bit smaller than others, or there's some cancellation at the order of, you know, 1 part in 10, so we can get 100 keV scale mass splittings. And finally, because of the Sommerfeld enhancement, we're not as reliant on sort of just hoping that the dark matter profile, or, you know, is clumped, that the density is higher for some reason than we expect. So there's a number of points that are nice about this type of particles.
And point one, the picture is that these light bosons are physically there and decaying. Are they virtual particles that are...
So in the annihilation, at least, that is, they're produced dominantly at resonance. So yeah, they're essentially physical particles. In terms of the XDM model, they're only virtual, but then the mass gap itself is small enough that they don't have enough energy to produce anything with electrons.
So the things that are actually annihilating through this resonance are very massive.
That's right.
And so, so what makes the resonance dominate everything else? It sounds like there would be a lot of energy available generically.
Well, I think it's just these sort of turning sharply peaked resonance. And it's a, well, I guess, like, it's a two-body. If you break it apart, it's a two-body decay versus a four-body one. So it gives phase space time.
Picture is that essentially 100% of the time, these big things are annihilating through this one channel.
That's right. Else before I move on. So, okay, in that case, let me just talk about sort of why we need these boost factors in the annihilation or scattering rates and how we could get them in Sommerfeld enhancement. Let's take the simplest case first. Then we have dark matter annihilating and we want to explain Panella or Attic. Well, in the early universe, when the velocity of dark matter particles is, well, about 0.2, so they're non-relativistic, so this is when they're freezing out. We know that the cross-section times velocity should be something like, you know, 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. Okay, and this is what we want to explain the abundance of dark matter. Cool. In our galaxy, though, the velocity is even smaller, which would, you know, you think drive this down. And, you know, if we know the density of dark matter, and we know number density. And what that tells us is that we need, well, from looking at the density, tells us we need sigma b to be 10 to the minus 23. So instead of going down, like you'd expect from the decrease in velocity, and you'd actually increase by a factor of 1,000, right? Now, perturbatively, if we look at the cross-section times the velocity, it's just constant. So it doesn't seem like you're going to increase by a factor of 1,000 as the velocity drops. However, due to some pretty simple quantum mechanics, there's actually a boost in velocity up to approximately a ratio of the dark matter mass to the gauge boson mass, you know, reduced by this fine structure. Again, dark versus fine structure. So let me explain how that works. And the key point is it's happening at low velocity. restriction of light. It doesn't affect, you know, all the physics of the early universe, but does affect what's happening in our galaxy.
And the first doesn't only have purple.
That's right.
Why is that?
Well, we'll see. Okay. So the point is, why is this only at low velocities? Well, it's because we're imagining these particles coming in and annihilating. If they're moving very quickly, essentially, the gauge bosons don't have time to pass in between them. But if they're moving slowly, there's a lot of time for a lot of virtual gauge bosons to add up in these ladder diagrams. Now, in the simplest case, let's think about annihilation of dark matter particles. Well, the annihilation is basically local. It happens on a length scale set by the mass of the dark matter particle, but it's essentially a point at the origin and the center of mass point. So in terms of partial waves, it's only the S wave that can lead to annihilation. In that case, we can think, well, what possible enhancement could there be? Well, the wave function of the dark matter particles moving slowly can be enhanced due to the fact that there's some attractive force due to these gauge bosons. Essentially, their wave function at the origin is enhanced compared to what you'd have just from a plane wave. If, for example, here, I've tried to sort of sketch out if you had pure Coulomb potential at some low velocity, well, there's your plane wave part of your wave function out here oscillating slowly, but then there's some large enhancement in the wave function here at the origin. And in fact, if you work it out carefully, this enhancement in the wave function grows like alpha over velocity. And if we go to the case of the Yukawa potential, it's appropriate for a spontaneously broken symmetry, then this saturates at about alpha m over mu, where mu again is the gauge bosons. Now we can actually get above that sort of saturation limit if there are bound states of the dark matter particle at near zero energy. So the boosting can actually even be higher. But it's really just doing quantum mechanics, looking at some attractive potential and asking, okay, how much does my wave function get enhanced? Now, higher partial waves can be important if you're talking about scattering or exciting, because this dark matter particle line here would be replaced by a gauge boson line, and we have dark matter particles coming out instead. And in that case, we're looking for enhancement of the wave function over this whole radius, 1 over mu. That's not been studied so much, and that's one of the things that we can do. So let me explain in a little more detail. There is some trouble with the usual exciting dark matter model. And the reason is this. Well, if you want to excite from some state 1 to 2, your velocity had better be enough that you've got enough kinetic energy to carry out that excitation. If the mass gap's really about an MeV, twice the electron mass, and the mass of the dark matter is about a TeV, then the minimum velocity you need is about 10 to the minus 3, and that's about the same as the expected RMS velocity of the dark matter in the center of the galaxy. What this means is, well, then you're only getting collisions from sort of the tail of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, which, you know, is really going to drive down the amount of excitation you can have. And, well, some people have hoped, well, maybe a lot of the higher partial waves contribute and that gives you some big enough boost to overcome this suppression. But what we've done is, in at least cases we can calculate numerically, we've gone ahead and calculated the enhancement due to various partial waves. We find that, in fact, the S wave is usually the dominant thing, and only a couple of partial waves contribute at all. So that's not very helpful. So it's hard to make this usual XDM scenario work without either a very clumpy density or hoping that the velocity profile of dark matter is, well, also uncertain, and actually dark matter is faster in the center of the galaxy. Now, there are models that do these things, so they're not completely ruled out, but again, you're hoping that sort of all your cards fall in the right direction. Whereas it might be nicer to have, again, some particle physics model that, that makes it a lot easier.
The
RMS velocity in the Gauss. So it's about 6 × 10⁻⁴ dimensions. So I think it's 220 something kilometers a second.
I thought V equals 10⁻³. It's very similar to the
Okay, it actually gets worse because there's a limit on how much decross-section can be enhanced, right? Just, again, from quantum mechanics, there's a unitarity limit on the cross-section you get from each partial wave that looks like this. And in fact, if you just plug this in, you can find, well, okay, what's the optimal mass the dark matter could have? About 700 GeV. But even if you were to get hit this unitarity limit, which our actual calculations show you don't, you'd still require the density to be about 20 times as big as this expected. Or, again, the velocities to be higher. And the point is, the fact that you've got a Yukawa potential because the gauge bosons are massive means that the higher partial waves are going to have sort of small contributions. You can't have too large of an impact parameter, basically, or else you just miss the region of where the Yukawa potential extends. So, like I say, standard XVM models have some trouble just due to the fact that dark matter doesn't seem to be fast enough or quite as dense as we'd like. Fortunately, we can fix this up fairly easily in particle physics. So most of the models dark matter they're trying to explain, Dama or integral, have some spectrum that looks basically like this top one. All the dark matter here is in some ground state, and okay, maybe there's a small splitting here that explains Dama, an elastic dark matter model, but it's just a spectator as far as integral is concerned. You've got these collisions, and they have to jump us up a whole MeV before we decay back down by an MeV. But suppose you've got this bottom spectrum for dark matter. If there's some population at this middle state of dark matter, those dark matter particles could collide, jump up, they only have to jump up about 100 keV or so. And then this excited state could then decay to the ground state. So you seem to engineer some model that has some stable population here. Right? And this avoids this whole Maxwell-Boltzmann compression, right? In this case, the benefits are that the minimum velocity we need to make this excitation is now considerably smaller than the expected RMS velocity. We don't have the suppression from the velocity distribution. Also, more partial waves can contribute. And in fact, again, by sort of scanning through what we could numerically, find that we can roughly optimize this at a dark matter mass of 500 GeV. This upper mass gap of about 86 keV, and the gauge boson mass of about 120, so 10. The trick is, of course, to have some stable population here. Let me explain. So here's our model. What are our goals? Well, we want to engineer this inverted dark matter spectrum for the purpose of XDM, exciting. And we need to keep this middle population stable through the whole life of the universe. Well, what that's going to mean is we need to generate the appropriate gauge boson masses and the symmetry breaking spectrum. We need to couple it to the standard model properly so that we get decays to E plus E minus. We'd like to get an annihilation spectrum that looks like what we'd see from Gamma 1 Attic. And finally, for this all to make sense, we need some consistent cosmological history. So that we know where it is. So here we go. The explain, start by just explaining the particle content and interactions. And they just have a simple SU2 gauge group. And let's write gauge bosons as, you know, a vector of SO3, right? I'll call B, B prime, and B double prime. Our dark matter particle is going to be a minor on a fermion that's also an SO3 vector. I'll call it 0, 1, and 2. Chi 1 is going to be this middle state, and chi 2 will be the excited state. And what we call the bare mass, or the mass before splitting, is going to be about 500 GeV. The gauge interactions are pretty standard, but they're shown with a vector. The gauge bosons pair up in this particular way. And finally, here's a Z2 symmetry. And the states in red are the ones that are charged under the Z2. You see that this chi1 particle carries the Z2 charge, so it's forbidden from decaying, which is what keeps the population of it stable through the lifetime of the universe. And of course, some of the gauge bosons are charged.
So I meant what I meant by chi1 and chi2.
Is that
compared to the index A, or two different types of?
Oh, so 0, 1, and 2 are the index A.
Are the chi's a different mass?
They're going to end up with different masses.
So you're breaking the SO3 symmetry somehow?
That's right. So I'll explain how to do that within the next couple of slides.
So your Z2 is a subgroup of SO2 plus SO3, is it?
Is
there a simple way to think of what Z2 is? Just the definition of Z2? It's just, you're saying it's 1 goes to minus 1 and B goes to minus B and B prime.
That's right, yeah.
Is there, what distinguishes 1 from 2 and 0?
Well, you can actually, you can just choose the, So the reason it's B and B double prime is because of this interaction, right? It's got to be two of them charged. And let me think. There are different ways you can choose it. I think you're probably right. It probably is a subgroup. But it's not broken by the symmetry.
What breaks the symmetry?
Did you ask? There's a big sector. The first model we built, and I think there could be others. We have some scalar delta that's in the adjoint, so guys, next A, and it's going to provide the mixing between the, the dark gauge bosons and hypercharge. We've also got a quintuplet, sigma AB, so that's a symmetric traceless tensor. That can have a Yukawa coupling with the dark matter, chi. Well, there's work in progress to see if we can do without that, but this is the simplest thing right now. And of course, both of these are going to get expectation values and add to the masses of these. There are also a couple particles we're going to introduce for cosmological reasons. One that we made and don't have to introduce is a heavy U1 vector called the Z prime. And don't necessarily have to introduce it, but it might be interesting to. And we're just going to assume that it couples to right-handed electrons. Don't have great motivation for that. But like I said, this is not something that's absolutely necessary for the model. And there's also going to be a heavy scalar S, which couples to the chi's through some non-normalizable interaction, which we're going to say is induced by physics at the gut scale.
So once you break SU2,
right.
Is there a neutral, one of those vehicles on the neutral? Could there just be usual kinetic mixing?
Well,
instead of having this higher dimensional operator or not? You can definitely have this.
Yeah, I don't think there's any other.
Because once you break it, then I would just imagine, the gauge symmetry will allow you to write down.
Right, but I think the point is, can we. So if you want the Lagrangian to be something that can explain things, that makes sense before the gauge symmetry is broken, right? And you need already, you missed the lowest dimension thing you can write down. Now, a lot of other groups will introduce an extra one into the dark sector, and then you can just directly couple that to hypercharge. But we'd rather not do that.
I just mean, like, once you broke it, if you, say, compute a quantum correction, would you,
right.
find, would you find that operator would be induced or whatever?
I don't know if it's guaranteed that it
would. It might not be.
I know some people who have been looking at questions.
What you've done is invented a phantom standard model of dark matter.
Sure. But there's no, it's actually still simpler than the standard model, because...
Well, you can make it as strong as you want.
You can, of course. But again, the philosophy is, why shouldn't there be, you know, more than sort of one particle of dark, right? If we were dark matter people looking at the standard model, only gravitational, the natural thing for us to think is, oh, just one particle interacting with this gravitational field. But
yeah, that's a better analogy, because we know that dark matter halos massively
sure.
extended beyond.
I'm sure this
so
is
we
true.
A strong, I mean, we have a strong presence. If you notice that dark matter was concentrated in the disk, then you'd think it had lots of different actions. But since
right.
we know that dark matter,
well,
it's primarily not.
But we know, okay, these are all weak scale interactions. And it's, you know, there's no real reason to think there should be only one particle in the dark matter.
There could be 1,000.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there
could be. The question is, how do you observationally? Everything in the end depends on experiment.
Yeah.
How do you decide
right?
that this is correct?
Well, okay, so this is not something I've been doing. I know a number of people have been looking into what would be potential signatures at, say, the LHC, or you know, if the ILC gets built. These kinds of dark matter models. Because there is a coupling to the standard model, there should be some production. And the fact that you've got some gauge group would give some particular signature. It's not something I'm an expert on, so I'm hesitant to try to answer in any kind of detail. But I can tell you that there are people working on, say, for example, what are collider signatures in these kind of models. So you'd be able to at least make some distinction. And another thing is, as we learn more, you know, potentially about the distribution of dark matter in the galaxy, it would help us narrow down at least what's required from a model like this. But, you know, I should stress, this is sort of a field that's only a few months old. Not all the implications have been explored. There are certainly people thinking about these issues. We only have symmetry breaking, and there can sort of generally be some massive equivalent potential. But let's just talk about what happens. Okay, so we can just do our gauge rotation to set the excitation value of delta in the one direction. And then due to this term here, sigma 01 and sigma 12 can be set to 0. Well, they're actually part of the Goldstone directions, but you know, you can really drive them to 0 if potential satisfies some conditions on the coupling constants. Now, there's still a couple of actual degrees of freedom left, which is the sort of the Bev or Higgs direction of sigma. And also, you can choose physically a little bit its orientation. The Goldstones don't pick that all up. So I'm just going to choose this potential such that sigma 1-1 is fixed, but small. Because we haven't explored that parameter space fully yet, and it's the simplest to represent. And I'm also just going to choose, again, by gauge rotation, that the remaining part of sigma is all in the 0-0 curve. If we do this, our gauge bosons B and B double prime have the same mass, although the sigma 1-1 component gives a small splitting, which I'm just going to ignore for now. And the B prime does not feel the delta, just the sigma. So we can, you know, pretty easily arrange to have mu bigger than mu prime by having delta sufficiently larger than sigma. And it's relatively simple to find some values for the scalar revs to give us the masses that we want. In particular, we want this mu prime, which mediates the excitation of the chi1 to the chi2, to be about 100 MeV. And that ends up setting the other two gauge bosons to have right. All right, symmetry breaking also through the loop diagrams splits the mass of the dark matter particles because, well, you see, there are different gauge bosons running in the different loops. And in particular, chi1 is split from chi0 and chi2 in the simplest model. But you know, if we also have a eukawa between sigma and the chi's, that also splits chi0 and chi2 from each other, we can arrange that to be about MeV. And there are also additional splittings if sigma 1, 1 is not 0, which we're looking at right now. It's possible that we can arrange it, so we don't need this eukawa at all, but we haven't explored that completely yet.
So the pattern of breaking was that when you had the, you turned delta on in the adjoint, that broke the SO3 gas to U1.
Yes.
And then the sigma broke that down to the subgroup Z2
that's
inside
right.
the U1.
That's right.
And that's what's keeping your septic guy stable, is that T2.
Yes.
And everything's happening in the GED scale. Is there a hierarchy problem there?
Well, and it's pretty mild, because suppose, again, we haven't thought about embedding this particular model in supersymmetry, but say the supersymmetry breaking scale of this field is this, non-equivalent TV. It's a fairly mild hierarchy problem.
Well, I guess I'm asking, are the scalars, are you expecting the scalars to all be running around at the same mass as the gauge bosons, or are they going to get made heavy compared to the TV scale loops?
Oh,
you
know, push them up to the TV. Well, we haven't really worried about the mass of the gauge bosons so much, although it's natural to think that their revs are around that mass.
So that won't play, they won't play a role in cosmology. I'm just thinking if
no, we're not, these scalars we're not going to, and they shouldn't play a role in cosmology. In particular, if they're light, if they stay light, they can only tell, as I'll explain in a minute. And actually, I think even if they're heavy, they're covered with a shock property. Their thermal abundance is pretty low.
In the standard matrix model, the Higgs scale, the Higgs power cannot be bigger than 800 GeV because
right.
nothing breaks down. So if you have this dark Higgs particle above a TeV, then when you construct the theory, you're going to have problems.
Well, these, like you said, these dark things, they should be less than a T per billion. In fact, with the Vesey postulate, it's more GeV-ish scale of the literature. But, you know, like I said, we're still sort of exploring all the possibilities of the model. Okay, in any case, we can write down sort of, if we go to the mass eigenvases and just look at the splittings, we want to arrange that this state M0 is about an MeV less than the other two. So this eukawa coupling and the mass splitting from the loops almost cancel. This should be about 100 KeV. So I know I'm trying to run out of time. I'll wrap up shortly. So we have a coupling to the standard model because we had that dimension 5 operator when delta gets a VEV in the one direction, it couples only the B prime to hypercharge. And if we diagonalize, we find that the B prime, so here's the charge eigenstate, and here are the mass eigenstates, couples really to the standard model primarily through the Z. One thing we'll note is that this means we can't use this IDM mechanism to explain gamma. And the reason really is this Z2 symmetry. And I just think of it this way. We can't have chi1, which is charging with a Z2, bounce off a nucleus, which is uncharged, and turn into a chi2, which is also uncharged. And so really, because most of the work that's been going into these particle physics models has been trying to explain IDM and XDM and all these things at once, they're or some papers that say, well, you really can't have a supersymmetry because it messes up gamma. Except we're kind of agnostic about that, so we don't mind. So we can see that this works well for these exciting dark matter models. When we get E plus E minus pairs, there's an enhanced chi1, chi1 to chi2, chi2 scattering, because we've engineered, you know, a light gauge boson that can attract them together, and then chi2 can decay. Dominantly, it's going to decay to E plus E minus and chi0, and there is a suppressed decay resistance supported. But like I said, the branching ratio is really quite dominant.
How dominant is
this? So I think it's about factor 10 to 8
or something. Sorry, why is E plus E minus dominant? You choose the dominant
set of resonance or something? No, the reason is because the this delta over lambda is a small parameter epsilon, and the thing that couples, so B prime over here, the untilted one, is the one that couples directly to the dark matter, and it only oscillates into photons at order delta over lambda squared. So delta over lambda is already about 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4, and so then you go to the next order, and you pick up that many more factors in the amplitude.
I kind of lost something in Z2. So you've got these two states, and they're stable because they have opposite charges of Z2. But you can get the positron thing happening because you can get a transition and it emits a gauge boson, which also carries a Z2, so it can carry the charge.
No. What it is, so the gauge boson doesn't have this Z2. What's happening is, so this intermediate state, chi1, is charged. It collides with another chi1 and excites two chi2s, which are both uncharged. So the Z2 charge has annihilated itself in this excitation.
Well, that's why you need two of them.
Yeah, so you need two of them. And then the chi2 can decay again to chi0, which is also uncharged. And the B prime is also uncharged.
And then the gauge boson for the B plus and minus chi's are neutral.
But it doesn't work for IDM because then you just have a single chi1. If you try to do IDM like for chi0, well, there's no state that's close to. Now, the annihilation signature, well, when we can either annihilate chi0 with chi0 or chi1 with chi1, this works just as standard picture of Sommerfeld enhanced annihilation. The B primes are produced dominantly on shell, which is why they can cut any only E plus E minus. But this gives us two E plus E minus pairs that are boosted with respect to each other, so there can be a relatively broad spectrum. Now, I've mentioned this Z prime, and I'm interested why it might be desirable later. If it couples sort of to, for some reason, leptons only, that could lead to a single E plus minus pair, which would be a much more sharper spectrum, which could potentially explain this PE structure in the attic data. But like I said, it's sort of an optional one. Okay, so let's look at the thermal relic density. The density left over at freeze-out for dark matter was like 1 over the cross-section. If you just use the parameters that we've chosen, the chi abundance, so the dark matter abundance, is too high. Now, it's not too troubling that maybe we need to increase the gauge coupling. Part of the reason we chose the gauge coupling that we did was because, well, larger gauge couplings were harder for us to do in the numerics and understand whether or not we would get the Sommerfeld. So we could potentially increase the gauge coupling, which would increase the perturbative cross-section and reduce the density. Or we can introduce this new Z-prime particle, which couples directly to leptons. And in that case, again, that could drive down the abundance, as well as, adding this attic peak. And because, in order to drive down the abundance, that means it's coupling is sort of the strongest thing around. It would explain why the peaky part of the attic structure is larger than the rest.
Kaiser chiral-like dark matter can create.
That's right.
Dark matter of liver velocities.
How do you call
it? Because the first two species.
So, right, so what would be left over? So, what would happen if freeze out is that you get essentially almost equal abundances of all three of the dark matter states. And the highest one would decay to the lowest one fairly rapidly. So, you'd have about two thirds in the ground state and a third in this sort of first stable excitement state.
So, wouldn't it be a problem to have that many parasitic electrons injected?
Well, because that's, you know, still at TV.
Large fraction. Yeah, it's over.
It's pretty rare. Okay, you just mentioned the gauge and scalar relics. It's a similar story, but, you know, if they're lighter, then the propagators going through here are a lower mass, which enhances the cross-section. You end up with actually negligible abundances after trouble. So. And the scalars are heavier than you need to assume that they come up there. Strong. So the point is, at least the gauge boson, we know any signals we'd see from them, in cosmology would just be, they'd be too, entirely too weak to see to affect anything, just because the abundance is so low. There is one problem with trying to use standard thermal freeze-out for dark matter. Suppose we have chi-to-chi scattering, like we've been talking about for XDM. If this stays in equilibrium at low kinetic energy, it just depletes the chi-1 particle, because again, it sticks to chi-2, which decays to chi-0. As long as that stays in equilibrium, then you're in trouble, you'll deplete chi-1 fairly quickly. In fact, when the kinetic energy of the chi is about the splitting MeV, the velocity is 10 to the minus 3, which is very similar to what it is in the galaxy. So the Sommerfeld enhancement is actually taking place, and you can work out that this would unfortunately stay in equilibrium. And get rid of this population of this excited state. If you use standard thermal generation of dark matter. However, if we look at this carefully, well, working out various scalings, we find that the equilibration rate n sigma v is always proportional to Hubble. And the question is, what's the proportionality constant? The point is, if there's sort of more momentum than you'd expect from thermal generation, so if these dark matter particles have more kinetic energy than you'd expect from thermal considerations, that means that the equilibration rate drops below the Hubble, and you don't have to worry about this kinetic equilibration process. That means we need to create these dark matter particles non-thermally. And that's where this heavy scalar S comes from. So suppose you've got a TeV scalar, so it's sort of near the cutoff, say the supersymmetry breaking scale, lambda TeV. So its mass and its expectation value for that scale. It can have a standard thermal whip abundance. And, well, remember, it was coupled to the dark matter particles through this higher dimension operator S squared, chi bar chi. Having a bev induces a U-Kawa coupling. So now this S particle can decay directly to the dark matter. And its decay rate is given by the ratio of the TeV scale to the gut scale. And it turns out this is, causes this S particle to decay quite late. It causes it to decay almost precisely as late as would be necessary to remove this kinetic equilibration process. It might seem a little artificial, but the fact that it's the gut scale that comes up here is an interesting coincidence, which is why I think it would be a little fast to say it's completely unnatural. In any case, we also need chi to have a low freeze-out density so that this non-thermal generation is most important thing. Also be interesting, having a low chi freeze-out density means that the gauge interactions can be stronger, and that might help with increasing some of the annihilation rates.
If you just live with thermal abundance, how depleted would the chi ones be?
Well, Well, the point is, this thing stays in equilibrium forever because.
Well, it doesn't freeze out.
It doesn't freeze out because, and you know, with this Sommerfeld enhanced cross section, it really is just proportional to h. The only time dependence is through the the G star standard model.
At some point, it must be that the Boltzmann suppression starts to kill the rate going one way.
So yeah, that's true. But then you'd have something exponentially suppressed. Chi 1 density compared to chi 0. It would really kill the whole thing.
So it's orders of magnitude down. Something like this down
there. Yeah. Okay, so I'll wrap up now and we're a little bit over. What are directions to take for the future? Well, at McGill, we're also working on trying to improve understanding of multi-state Sommerfeld enhancement, because most of the work has just been done in case of, you know, single states annihilating. We're working on WKB approximations for instance, difficulties in numerics. In particle physics, we're trying to look at more detailed explanations of this model. In particular, you know, can we change the Higgs sector? Do we need these utility, and so on. And another question that we're probably going to ask at some point is, if we take other representations for the dark matter, can we get this to also work for AM and explain Dhamma, not because we're necessarily fond of Dhamma, but because it would be interesting to see that. And finally, you know, cosmologically, you can ask, as I mentioned a moment ago, are there advantages of generating dark matter non-thermally? In other words, can get around maybe some of the usual constraints on WIMPs. And we'd also like to do a more detailed calculation of the signals in this particular one. So I'll just conclude by saying right now, it's an exciting time to be working at DARPA.
We had all the questions during the talk, but we have time for more. But if anyone needs to investigate.
This, when you think of, when you discuss of a non-thermal production, darkness produced after preserved temperature.
That's right. So right. You just, you have the dark matter would freeze out with a very low abundance compared to normal.
Still, you have to think about this some of it in estimate when you have abundant.
So, well, the reason we were thinking about the Sommerfeld enhancement was because there's processes of sort of just kinetic equilibration where the dark matter at late times can sort of change states from one to the other. Okay? And so then we needed, if the dark matter were thermally generated, that would end up depleting this middle population. So that's why we want to consider that the dark matter could be generated in some non-thermal process. I don't know if this is exactly answering your question.
The last statement is dark matter is exciting right now. The dark matter problem is 75 years old.
Yeah, sure.
Why do you think it's more exciting now than it was?
Well, I think it was pretty exciting then, but I think the reason it's interesting to be working on right now is that we're starting to get, what could be a little bit of observational information about it, but also there are recently proposed theoretical ideas that make understanding that possible. Relatively simple particle physics setup. And I think that's why, a lot of people or sorry, maybe in addition, it's a great pun.
We have a hard time detecting the Higgs bar.
Sure.
Let alone detecting a dark matter Higgs bar.
Well,
I mean, think about the issue here.
Yes, it's not the dark matter things I think that people would be hoping to detect in the colliders, but maybe the dark matter particle itself, which is a little more directly coupled. But again, these are small signals, but they're things that people are considering seriously to determine, exactly what would be detectable or not.
But the point, right, is that you can't explain all of these experiments with astrophysics, and you have to explain it with something.
Well, that's certainly right thing. And we, yeah, I mean, the thing is, we don't, you know, there are proposed astrophysical explanations for all these things, but they're all, you know, uncertain, and they'd have to fall out in just the right way. There's, you know, if we take all these different signals seriously, we get some picture of dark matter that's actually relatively simple. You know, maybe it's a matter of taste whether you prefer astrophysics or particle physics. But, well, maybe it's better to be prepared in case of astrophysics.
Why did you put the damage? Why did you give them my random answers?
Oh,
I'm giving the dark ones as well?
Okay, so why am I I'm not sure if there's any real important
thing.
Yeah. I'm not sure that there's anything. But, you know, this sort of air master is not the most important thing. It's the splitting.
The drone mass as well as the my own mass. Yes, that would affect the mass making.
Yeah,
probably. Yeah, so this way you can kind of compute this way. We have it set up.
Well, here
you kind of compute them from the quantum effects.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you can.
You scale representation real.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so
you could you write down
right?
Right.
This is just a triple.
Why is that an answer? I mean, because it's real, you can have a mind on a mask, but that doesn't include it in that
one.
The reality just says a mind on a mask is aligned. It doesn't say I'm drag mask at this point.
Right. Yeah, no, I don't know if there's any real reason why you can't have a current
mask. I don't think I could position into this additional real scale strictly to get a mask on. Only with a single triplet, I put them right now.
So why not?
Thinking, I know.
About coming still an SOC singlet.
Yeah.
Have you figured out if these signals are really not astrophysical the particles? Like, how long will I have to wait right in the room to see an electron positron pair up here? I have nothing.
I think it. Probably quite a
lot. But you would never know this, right?
I don't know that you're sitting right here and you have the gamma ray. If you have a violation in time,
suppose you have
a pair up here, right? That'll be fairly noticeable.
That's why they
don't use
it underground, right?
No, you have to do it underground, and so you get rid of the usual things.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
No, I'm not this room.
Especially in my room.
You have to screen for the usual.
The spectrum.
Yeah.
But I think the dark matter mass increases a fair amount towards the center of the galaxy. So in terms of
the number density, it's much higher.
It's n squared, so it really spikes at the center of the galaxy.
Yeah, that's right. So I think.
The trick point, right, is that the rate just has to be high enough to see one in, ever. Right.
I would think that would be a fairly noticeable, a fairly easy experiment.
Well, the thing is, this is essentially what Kamel and Attic are looking for. Right?
So the point is, if you
screen away from that.
Well, there you're looking at a much larger, I guess, volume. Yeah, I don't know the number though. Considering the volume that the Kamel and Attic are looking at compared to for any of the pressure on and the rates of the pattern, it's probably pretty long time.
We know from galaxy rotation curve data that the core disk of our galaxy, you can use Newtonian gravity, which means it's effectively no dark matter in Sagittarius. So you have to go out to 8 kiloparsecs or more before the rotation curve flattens out.
Right, sure.
So we're 8 kiloparsecs from the center of the galaxy. So we have some hope of seeing dark matter particles here on Earth.
Yeah, well,
but to see them from the center of the galaxy just doesn't fit the data, as Mark pointed out. This is the last place you want to look.
Well,
You said that talking about is primarily in the halo, not the core.
Well, no,
the halo,
the density peaks before. In IA models, it goes like 1 over R, so it's a cusp. The fact is that the baryons are increased even faster.
So you can
have baryons dominate and still have a lot of dark matter. Because dark matter is very, very diffuse everywhere.
The theory, the mass profiles, this is the problem with the galaxy data, that you don't want the dark matter.
All you need is baryons.
But you just need
the baryons to dominate. So last question and
sure.
Okay, last question.
And not very well acquainted, but how the model is relates with these ball clusters, which it seems like a two solos.
The sort of picture of the bullet cluster is that the dark matter doesn't interact as much as gas, say. So it passes through much more without interaction so much. And, I think, what you have to ask here is maybe now, if we're considering these various enhancements in scattering, could the dark matter slow itself down? But I think it's still weak enough interaction that it wouldn't have a noticeable effect on
them. Well, it's little. If you map J 2007, papers published, what we call the anti-bullet cluster, APO520 emerging cluster, which has the opposite result from the bullet cluster. So it's not necessarily good to use a bullet cluster. It's a popular thing to show.
Yeah, sure.
We don't understand this thing yet.
No, I don't necessarily think that it's absolutely understood, but there is a reasonably accepted explanation for it. And it makes an explanation.
How many gliding systems are there going to have? So 20 years from now, are we going to have two, like a bullet and anti-bullet, or will there be a population of 10 that can look at the systems?
Well, the APO520 is published in that shape.
Yeah,
it's a Victoria group. And the dark matter has not separated from the plasma percentage.
Sure.
Whereas the galaxies have clean.
But the way these things normally get resolved in astrophysics is that you go to a whole bunch of them and look at systematics. So I'm just asking, what's the prospects for that? So we're just really in the few.
I'm looking at two. One, the magical cluster annihilates the bullet cluster.
I think the question was maybe, how likely are we to find more examples and figure out what's the typical.
Yeah, but like you're saying, there are no more.
They have to be a line which is right, so you can do a line of sight observation.
Yeah. Anyway, so Andrew is here tomorrow still. There are still opportunities in 257, so on the second floor. Anybody want to see him? Let's take him.